calling A241045 in the matter of the welfare of the children of GUT.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's December 11th. This will be recorded and the audio version will be made available later. It's also being live streamed. So please make sure as you approach the podium and start your argument to say your name and who you represent so we have a record of that. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for respondent, you'll have 5 minutes for your argument. And counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm sorry, 15 minutes, counsel for respondent. I don't know if I said that right. Anyways, the podium will adjust, so feel free to get settled in. Right in the sort of center underneath the podium, there's some arrows that will take it up and down. Counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you can go ahead and get set up at the podium and begin when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Brooke Beskow-Warg, and I represent Appellant Father GUT in this appeal of the order terminating his parental rights to his three children. Father asks this court to reverse the termination of parental rights because the district court abuses discretion in determining that termination of father's parental rights was in the best interests of the children. Termination of parental rights is always discretionary with the district court. Even when a statutory ground exists, which the court found two of them here, the district court can still decline to terminate a parent's rights if it determines that the termination does not serve the best interests of the children. In this case, father, the children's mother, all three children who are ages 11 to 14 years old, and the guardian ad litem, whose job and responsibility it is to speak for the best interests of the children, opposed the termination of father's parental rights. When weighing the best interest factors, and there are three, the district court found that the children have an interest in preserving their relationship with their father. The district court also found that the father has a limited interest in preserving that relationship with his children. However, the court found that any competing interests of the children outweigh the interests that father and the children have in maintaining their relationship.
I just want to make sure I'm clear. You're not challenging the statutory grounds, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so it's only the best interest factors?
Yes.
And you cited the children's preference as a reason the district court abuses discretion. Were the children aware of the conviction that father was in prison for?
So the testimony on that, mother did testify that she had not told them. It's a little bit unclear. I don't know if the record is 100% clear whether the children know. As the court is aware, child two did testify at the trial. I believe child two was there the entire time. So it appears child two should be aware of what had happened with father. As far as the other two children, the record isn't 100% clear on that, but mother did testify that she had not shared that conviction with them.
So if that's the evidence before us, that mother hasn't shared that information with the children, then how much weight do we give to the children's preference where it wasn't really an informed preference?
Well, I think as far as child two, who again did testify and who appears to have been at the trial, I think, you know, child two is aware of, or it appears child two is aware of the father's convictions. And so I think that the analysis for child two is a little bit different. Again, it's a little bit unclear for the other ones. However, I would also note that part of appellant's argument is that there is not clear and convincing evidence in the record that father even poses a risk to these children, to his own children. And so that undercuts the district court's analysis because essentially the district court weighed the child's preference against their need for safety.
How do you reconcile that with the finding, which I think is undisputed, the child isn't, or that father is an untreated sex offender with two convictions for sexually assaulting minor children, including one of the child's friends and impregnating her.
And that absolutely is in the record. We do not dispute that. I would reconcile it by arguing that we certainly have that evidence in the record, but we don't have anything connecting the dots in a clear and convincing way that father, because he has these other convictions, that he poses any risk to his own children.
I'm not talking about the convictions. I'm talking about the fact that he is an untreated sex offender.
Sure, and we do also have the evaluation and report, but again, we still don't have anything connecting the dots between father's actions or inaction, as the court is noting, and whether he actually poses a safety risk to the children. The only thing we have in the record that I found on this point is the caseworker's testimony. That raises the question of whether that testimony alone, which is opinion testimony, she did not author the report, she did not conduct the assessment, she did not evaluate father, is that clear and convincing evidence that father poses any sort of safety risk to his children, especially in light of the fact that the record also shows us that the children all have said they feel safe with their father. They love their father. They have not been assaulted by their father. They have not been touched inappropriately by their father. They have not been abused by their father. We have this conflicting evidence that does show that they have a relationship and it's a positive relationship versus unconnected dots on the other evidence.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Ward, but wasn't there some testimony or some evidence that father had threatened at least one of the children with an assault at some point in time?
Your Honor, I'm not recalling that testimony. I could certainly take a look, but
I'm
not recalling
that testimony.
No, it's all right.
Maybe I missed. It's a large record, so maybe I'm misrecalling. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I also want to just back up one step and sort of, before diving in any further, address respondent's argument that what appellant is asking this court to do here is to reweigh the evidence or to question the district court's credibility findings. That's not what we're asking the court to do here. We understand that this court has practice and precedent, that it follows on those points. What I'm asking the court to do here is to look carefully and closely at the record and the district court's analysis and determine that there was not clear and convincing evidence, as we've already sort of discussed here, that father presents a safety risk to his children, that there's not clear and convincing evidence that a termination of father's parental rights will ensure the safety of his children or the stability of the children, that the district court improperly imposed on father, who is a non-custodial parent, the duties and obligations of a custodial parent when determining that the termination is in the best interest of the children, and as we also already touched on, the district court's decision to override the children's preference in this case was an abuse of discretion because it's contrary to the logic and facts on the record. Namely, that again, the court weighed the children's preference against their need for safety when it's unclear from this record and certainly not clear and convincing that father actually poses a safety risk to his children.
Why is the social worker's testimony not enough? I mean, the district court found the social worker credible and found it persuasive that he would not complete sex offender treatment. And there is a risk of harm to his children.
And we'd assert that that testimony alone, which is opinion testimony by a caseworker who, again, did not conduct the evaluation, who did not author the report, that alone is not enough to connect the dots between father's actions and inactions and whether he actually poses a risk of harm to the children. I don't think it meets that clear and convincing evidence standard and certainly does not rise to that level.
And you don't think that it's an appropriate or you believe it's an abuse of discretion for the district court to have made inferences from the fact that father is a level 4 sex offender and that his lack of treatment or acknowledgement of his prior convictions and lack of demonstrated remorse related to the underlying conduct supporting those convictions does not pose a threat. I think it's the district court described a grave threat to the safety of the children. It's not a fair inference?
I think sure, an inference could be made. I don't know that there's clear and convincing evidence that these children are at risk. And the district court relies very heavily, as the court noted, on this perceived risk to the children, but without a foundation for it, without clear and convincing evidence that that risk actually exists for these children. And I think that is where the abuse of discretion came in, especially when considering how heavily and how often the weighing of the factors came down to safety versus a different factor. In this case, child's preference, even in the case of the guardian ad litem's testimony, and so forth. I also want to note on the topic of safety that at the time of trial, and even currently, Father is incarcerated for his crimes. He does not currently pose any sort of risk of harm to these children, and so it really calls into question the timing, again, of this termination of parental rights. Why did we need to terminate this father's parental rights when he is not, at the time of trial, posing any risk of harm to these children? I think that also is an important point in the analysis, that the district court did address somewhat, but I think is important to note here.
Is his out date at the end of next year? Is that right?
I believe the record indicates it's approximately October 2025.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So there is some time between now and then where he does not pose that risk of harm. In terms of stability, the court also weighed the stability factor against many other factors in determining that the best interests of the children were served by termination. It's unclear on this record how a termination of father's parental rights will result in any sort of stability for these children. If anything, it acts as a destabilizing factor for their family. This is the family that they've always known. This is the structure that they've always known. The children live with their custodial parent, their mother. She has full legal, physical, legal and physical custody of the children. I don't believe the record indicates in any way that these children have ever lived with their father or that he has acted as their primary caretaker or that he has attempted to do so in the past. Respondent says, well, that factor.
On that fact, did I see somewhere that there was, that he was living with the family when he had a failure to register?
At one point, he was living with the family for a period of time, yes.
Okay.
But he has not acted as the primary caretaker for these children. Again, they are in the custody of their mother. They remained in the custody of their mother throughout this case. So on that record and on those facts, it's unclear how the district court determined or what the court is basing its determination on as far as the termination being something that will increase or ensure stability for the children. There is sort of this hypothetical out there or this speculation out there that father at some point in the future could petition the court for some sort of custody or parenting time. Again, he's never done that. There's nothing in the record indicating that he plans to do that or that he has done that in the past or that he has otherwise served to disrupt the family structure as it is.
I want to follow up on Judge Smith's question because I heard part of an answer. So he was living with the family, but was that at a time when he was supposed to have to be registered and failed to do so?
I believe that's what the record shows, okay. Your Honor. Yes. I would also note that I don't believe that at that time there was any harm to the children either. In terms of he did not offend against the children during that time period. There is no accusation that he did anything inappropriate in terms of the children at that time. So I believe that is what the record shows.
So I guess the question that would be out there is if you have, if father has two convictions for criminal sexual misconduct against young teenage, 14, mm-hmm. 15-year-old, and now the children are reaching that age, what is required to establish clear and convincing evidence that he poses a threat to their, clear and convincing evidence that there's a safety risk?
I think had the individual who authored the report, who assessed father, had come in and testified that, you know, under the circumstances of what we have here, that there is a high risk that he is likely to offend against his own children. If perhaps there was a history involved of father offending against a relative or another one of his own children, that may establish clear and convincing evidence. We simply just don't have anything connecting the dots here between his status as a sex offender and an untreated offender and a risk of harm to these particular children. We don't have anything establishing that, and I don't think that that reaches the clear and convincing evidence standard.
And the thing that might be there short of, I mean, clearly he doesn't have to abuse them in order for there to be clear and convincing evidence that he will in the future, obviously, right? But you're saying that what would need to be there is an assessment that finds that? I'm trying to figure out, short of actually abusing them or having abused them in the past, what would be enough to prevent by termination?
And I think if the assessment had said that there is a risk of this, that the assessor had taken into account the fact that father is a father of multiple children, some of which are in the age range of his of the individuals that were the victims in those cases, that perhaps that would connect the dots. If we had someone testify as to much, even if it wasn't written in the report, that might be enough, but we just simply have not reached that standard here. And I see my time is just about up, so I'll answer any additional questions on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for respondent, when you're ready, you will have 15 minutes. Feel free to adjust the podium as needed and begin when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Britta Nicholson from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I am appearing on behalf of the respondent in this case, who is the Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department, who I will be referring to as the department throughout the argument this morning. Appellant's arguments in this case are unavailing, given the district court's considerable discretion when evaluating a child's best interests, the district court's thorough and well-reasoned best interests analysis in this case, the district court's explicit credibility findings in its order, and the evidence in the record. As a threshold matter, it is important to note that the district court dedicated 9 single-spaced pages to its analysis of the children's best interests, relying on testimony and evidence presented at trial. The analysis was thorough and thoughtful, citing to testimony, exhibits, statutes, and precedential case law to support its conclusions. The district court acknowledged evidence and arguments that supported appellant's position and explained why they were outweighed by evidence and arguments to the contrary. The district court's order conducted the requisite balancing analysis of the 3 best interest factors, and it clearly explained its rationale for concluding why a termination of parental rights was in the best interests of these children. And that rationale, which was based on the district court's explicit credibility findings and how it weighed the evidence, is entitled to significant deference on appeal. I would like to begin by addressing appellant's arguments regarding the safety risk posed by appellant to these children. First and foremost, both statutes and case law promote the idea that sex abuse of any child does create safety concerns for the perpetrator's biological children. For example, in the egregious harm subdivision, it contemplates that there is a concern that sexual abuse of any child could create a concern that is contrary to the best interests of a child or any child to be in the parent's care. So even within that statutory basis, it links egregious harm to the best interests of a child.
I don't think that there's a dispute about that. My read or my understanding of appellant's argument here is that there was no testimony or evidence connecting the fact that father is a level 4 untreated sex offender with multiple convictions to a specific harm that's posed to these children, that he will offend in a similar manner with respect to them. Do you want to address that that argument that there's a gap in record evidence that would satisfy the clear and convincing standard?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe appellant would even agree that there is evidence in the record to make that link between his predatory behavior and the risk to the children, specifically in the form of the testimony from the social work supervisor, who expressly testified that he was a safety risk to his own children. And the district court made a lot of credibility findings in its order, and even a specific amount of credibility findings regarding that social work supervisor's testimony. In general, it found her testimony credible, but then the district court went so far as to break down individual pieces of the supervisor's testimony that the district court expressly found credible. And one of those findings was the district court finds that the supervisor's testimony that he poses a safety risk to his own children, the district court expressly found that to be credible. And the social worker explained in her testimony why she made that link. She referenced the psychosexual evaluation, which did find that he was at an above average risk to reoffend. She also discussed and testified to her concerns that he had not completed sex offender treatment in the past, and that in her professional opinion, he was unlikely to do so in the future. And that was based on his prior failure to complete sex offender treatment and the 20-year gap between his two offenses, and also his expressed statements in the psychosexual that he did not want to do sex offender treatment. And the assessor even asked him, well, what if it was a condition of a plea agreement? And he said, no, I would not complete sex offender treatment. In addition, the social work supervisor testified to her concerns that he does not have boundaries when it comes to his children and his sexually abusive conduct. Specifically, she referenced the fact that he abused somebody, I believe her language was close to the family, which was that second victim who was a friend of his daughter's. And in a way, he kind of used those daughters to get access to that victim because they all three went to his caddy waiver home together, and then those daughters left the victim alone with their father. So there is evidence in the record to support the social work supervisor's testimony. And then by comparing the case law in addition to other items in the record, that these children are at a heightened risk of sexual abuse from their father due to the fact that they have not had any therapy to process their trauma for the child that was abused, or any education for the other children about how to protect themselves from sexually predatory adults. And the mother's testimony at trial, unfortunately, demonstrated that she does not have insight into the need for such services, and she herself has not received education about how to protect her children. There's evidence in the record. For example, the guardian said, oh, I believe that these children are able to self-advocate. However, there is ample evidence in the record that these children are not able to protect themselves. Exhibit 8, which was the Center for Safe and Healthy Children report regarding Child 2, talked about how children are unlikely to report sex abuse by somebody they're close to, such as a parent. And there is evidence in the department's SSIS notes that these children have been coached by their mother to stay silent. I believe the line in the exhibit was to keep their mouth shut. So they've been well trained to keep their mouth shut. And concerns that the mother encourages them to recant when they do disclose sexual abuse. For example, for child one, who I acknowledge was not a subject child in this case, but child one was also sexually abused by another father of one of the children, disclosed the sexual abuse, and then after being left alone in a room with mother, all of a sudden ran up to the social worker and said, oh, I made it up because I wanted him out of the house. And the social worker even acknowledged in her notes that that was extremely suspect to her because the only other time she'd heard that allegation was from mother herself. So there is evidence in the record that these children are, and in addition to that, on that point, there is ample evidence that this mother is unable to protect her children because she doesn't see appellant as a risk, and she historically has been unable to protect them from repeated sexual abuse, including from another father of one of these children. So that, in addition, heightens the safety risk that appellant poses to these children in this particular case. And regarding the lack of insight and the absence of programming, which the social worker identified as one of her concerns for the safety risk appellant poses to the children, that is supported by case law that I cited in my brief, namely the KLW case and the ALF case, both of which are published precedential cases, which establish that when a parent has a lack of insight and a lack of accountability for their prior crimes, and they have not completed any programming, that does enhance the safety risk for the subject children in that case. And in this case, appellant's lack of accountability is all over the record. It comes through in his psychosexual assessment, where he blames one of the assaults on the fact that he was high on ecstasy. He blames another assault on the victim by saying that she was the one who initiated the sexual conduct. He denies knowing that the victims were children at the time, despite the ample evidence in the record that speaks to the contrary. And even when he testified at trial, he said, you know, oh, I didn't, I believe the terms that were being used at trial was, oh, I didn't rape anybody. And then when confronted with the fact that it was a child, he's like, oh, well, I guess you could call it statutory rape, and kind of minimizing it in that regard. He even made statements at trial that I don't agree with, with what I was convicted of. And he honestly seemed proud of himself for what he called creating a life with somebody who is now 18 years old, is what he said. So he has an alarming lack of insight and accountability, showing that he really doesn't think his behavior was wrong, and he thinks it's okay to have sex with teenage girls, which, as I believe one of your honors pointed out, when he is released from custody, his children will be teenage girls, which places them at an even heightened risk now that they would be in the preferred age range and gender of his prior victims. And then regarding the absence of programming, which heightens the safety risk, as identified by the social work supervisor and identified in the case law, the record is clear that he had ample opportunity to complete sex offender programming starting all the way back in 2001, and he failed to do so. He mentioned some programming through a program he called Triad, which was behavioral modification. But it's unclear that that rose to the level of full-fledged sex offender programming. And even if that would have had some type of remedial effect, it didn't work for him in this case because he still reoffended after completing that programming. And then perhaps the most concerning thing, well, he did testify at trial that he would be willing to complete such programming. That testimony was not credible given his history, his failure to complete any programming in the past. For example, in the 2019 child protection case, the department repeatedly referred him for a psychosexual evaluation, and he failed to return any of the calls, and he failed to even complete that evaluation. And then, of course, the most concerning thing we have is his psychosexual assessment, stating that he is blatantly unwilling to do any sex offender treatment, even if it's part of a plea agreement. So based on the case law, the statutes, there's just plain logic when you have children that are in his gender and age range of his victims that he would potentially have access to if his parental rights weren't terminated. And based on the social work supervisor's testimony, which the court found credible and is consistent with the other evidence in the record, there is a clear safety risk to these children, and that finding was not clearly erroneous. Just, I would like to point out that distinction as well, that, well, the ultimate conclusion about a child's best interest is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. The factual findings underlying that conclusion are reviewed for clear error. So in this case, the court made a factual finding that this father is a safety risk to his children, and based on all of the evidence and all of the case law I just went through, that was not a clearly erroneous finding that needs to be overturned on appeal.
Maybe you're not, as we leave that topic, can you address the argument that it's nevertheless an abuse of discretion to deter, or against logic and facts in the record, to terminate, considering that father was not custodial, so his access is not, and I guess historically his access before, I don't know, I mean, he did live with them for a while, I'm not sure how that factors into the district court's thinking, but is non-custodial and that, in any event, terminating doesn't mean that the father can't be around the children.
So I'll begin by kind of addressing the argument, appellant's argument that even terminating parental rights won't actually increase safety for the children. The district court did expressly address that argument in its order, and I believe included a finding that the social work testified about it would increase safety. The district court explicitly found that piece of her testimony credible, and I believe the district court said it outweighed any other arguments to the contrary. So that is entitled to deference. But in addition, as I argued in my brief, there would be an increased safety because it would empower the mother to establish boundaries and protect the children from father if she developed that insight and saw him as a danger in the future. The record is very clear that her relationship with the father is tumultuous. There's kind of a pendulum swing where there are periods where she doesn't want him around, she blocks his phone number, she tells the department he doesn't do anything for the children and I don't want him involved. but then the pendulum will swing the other way, and she'll let him live in the home, even though he's a registered sex offender. She will object to the TPR. She will be very clear. She will allow him to have contact with the children. So recognizing the fact that that relationship is tumultuous and the pendulum can swing, there may be a point in the future where this mother realizes he's a danger to the children and does want to protect her children, and this termination of parental rights would give her greater legal authority to do so. In addition, and during the times when the pendulum is swung the other way, where she wants to allow him contact with the children, the termination of parental rights would either serve as a deterrent to her or as a consequence to her by allowing that contact, because by the maltreatment statute, there is the term threatened injury is defined as allowing access to a variety of people, including those that have been found palpably unfit by the court and those who have an involuntary TPR. So if she were to, on one of those pendulum swings where she's aligned with father, if she were to allow access, there could be a basis for a new child protection report for her allowing access to father because he was found palpably unfit and because his parental rights were terminated. So that's an additional layer of safety for the children. In addition, there was testimony that the court found credible that a TPR would eliminate his legally enforceable right to visitation and remove him from custodial consideration if the mother were to become available to parent at any point in the future. The social work supervisor testified to this, and it is supported by case law. For example, the ER case, which is unpublished but can still be persuasive, discusses how that there is a presumption that a natural parent, whether they're custodial or not custodial, is presumed to be suitable to care for their children. So if he retained his parental rights and something were to happen to mother, he would be legally looked to first as an option for these children. And then we have the ASR case, which I believe and I want to highlight as probably the most persuasive case that is relevant to this case, because many of appellant's arguments mirror those that were made by the appellant in the ASR case. And in that case, the appellant argued that his risk of future contact with the children was unlikely given his status as a sex offender, and the financial benefits outweighed any safety risks. However, the court found that even if it would be unlikely that this father would obtain custody or obtain significant visitation, the mere risk of future contact with the children still weighs in favor of a termination of parental rights. So the ASR case directly addressed that argument in circumstances similar to the case we have at hand and found that a termination of parental rights was still in the children's best interests. And regarding his role as a non-custodial parent, there is adequate case law that even if he's non-custodial, there still are presumptions that he should care for the children, protect the children, and act in their best interests. And I see I'm out of time, so I will just say the record is abundantly clear in this case that he is not a suitable parent for these children. He is a safety risk to these children, and the district court's analysis was not an abuse of discretion. So I'd respectfully request that the district court's order be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, feel free to adjust the podium again, and when you're ready, you have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to just address a few points here and go back to the argument that there is not clear and convincing evidence in the record that termination will result also in an increased safety for these children. We talked about how, you know, there's not clear and convincing evidence that father presents a risk of harm, but there's also not clear and convincing evidence that that the termination will actually create more safety for these children. Respondent argues that the TPR puts mother in full decision-making power. Mother is essentially already in full decision-making power. She has full legal and physical custody of these children. That's how it's always been, and she has had the ability to protect the children through that physical and legal custody and decision-making power. Nothing really changes here, and for that reason, it's against logic and facts to pursue that termination. The court also did not make any findings about respondents' argument that there could be potential consequences for mother with a termination of parental rights. Even if that were true, the court did not rely on this. This was an argument put forth by the county, I believe, in its closing and again on appeal. But again, the court did not factor that into its reasoning, and so I don't believe that that should be considered now. I'd also like to address the ASR case because, as respondent notes, there are some similarities. I do believe that in that case, Father, there was a more direct cause of or a direct safety concern because Father in that case had abused one of his own children. Again, that is not the case here. That differentiates that case from the case at hand, and I believe that is a significant point as well. If the court has no other questions, I just want to remind the court that we have a case here where we have three children, 11 years old and older, that have stated their preference that their father's rights not be terminated. And a termination of parental rights that can severely disrupt a family structure, can severely disrupt a child's life, we need to have that count for something in these cases. In this case, it wasn't. And for those reasons, and because the best interest analysis overall was an abuse of discretion, I would ask this court to reverse the termination of father's parental rights. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments today and for your briefs. The case is submitted, and we will get an opinion out within the statutory time frame. And with that, we'll move on to the next case. Thank you both.